Hello, my dears. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. And we are on the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, like us, subscribe, share, tell your friends, give us some stars, because we would love to get bumped up in the rankings so more and more people can find out about our little podcast, because we are all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music business today. We are all about getting the tools and resources and advice and tips that you need to get that successful music career. So thank you as always in advance for your love and your support. We just adore you back. So last episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Ella Gregg. She is the co-founder of 321 Artists. That's right. She is another badass boss lady, female music entrepreneur. We love to support that here on the podcast. And she has just an amazing story. She started managing her first band, I believe, at the tender age of 18. And she is not stopping and in any way, shape, or form. So just a great story. Go on back and listen to that when you get a moment. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Teresa Teague. She is, in my opinion, another badass boss lady. What I love so much about her story is that it's non-linear, it's non-typical. This is somebody who has worked her ass off with a lot of tenacity, grit, determination to really follow that passion. And you're going to hear her story. It took a very long time for her to get to where she is today. Very inspiring. And it just goes to show you, you know, when you really have a passion for music, you don't give up and you just keep pursuing it by whatever means you can. So before we do that, we're actually going to play a track from one of her touring clients. This is Makumba, and the track is Moose Wale. Here we go. Hey, Teresa, welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Hey, Elle Ariel. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you too. So tell me about your first memories of music. Tell me about what it was like growing up in your household.
My first memory of music was actually hearing my dad play the trumpet. I think I was about, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years old, roughly. And my dad used to come home every day from work, and in order to de-stress himself from the day, he would blow his trumpet. He played in school. He was a hobbyist. Both my parents were sort of, they weren't musicians per se, but they were hobbyists. My dad played the trumpet. He also played the guitar and sang folk songs and bluegrass tunes and stuff. And my mom, she played the piano a little bit. We had a piano in the house. But my dad was really an audiophile. So he used to play jazz records and bluegrass records. That's what I mostly remember when I was a kid, on our hi-fi stereo. And he would play his trumpet along with Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
Nice.
Yeah. I started listening to pop radio at a pretty young age. I was just always into music. So I would listen to pop radio and the rock artists of the day, which was like Led Zeppelin and Rolling Stones back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I also took dance lessons as a kid from a very young age up until through college, and I got exposed to music through dance as well.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah, so that exposed me to classical music and some other forms, Broadway too, stuff like that.
Now, you were saying you're not a musician. Did you play the piano at all, or did they make you take lessons or anything?
I think I might have taken maybe just a one session of lessons, but I just wasn't really into it, and I wasn't really good at it, and my parents weren't the type to force us kids to do music or, you know, take lessons or anything. And my sister and I, we both took dance lessons. And so that was our thing that we did. Other kids did sports. My sister and I did dance.
I want to hear more about that because I really think that there's a really strong connection with music in terms of dance. And it's a different, obviously like a different way of experiencing it and interpreting, but it's like you really kind of get into the nuts and bolts of the song structure and different genres and that kind of thing. So I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Well, my sister was initially put into dance classes because she had a condition that back in the day they used to call knock knees. And so her legs were a little, you know, splayed out. And so she was put into dance classes to correct that condition. And my mom just put me in dance classes along with her. You know, dance is really, it's the physical embodiment of the music. So from a young age, it was just through muscle memory, I learned that, you know, how I learned the connection between movement and music, and I would tune into certain parts of the music, which I even do even now when I'm listening to a band or just listening to some of my favorite music. I cue into certain instruments. I'm really a drum and bass girl, and that's what I'll tune into, and that's the part of the music that my body will move to. So I definitely feel that connection to the music and feel it in my body.
I like that a lot. Now, what types of dance were you taking?
Ballet, tap, jazz, and gymnastics.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, all of it.
And then you pursued it through high school to college?
Well, yeah, it was, and for me, I was what I call myself a hobbyist with dance. Again, and like in school, it was the thing that I did instead of sports because I wasn't good at sports. And then I just continued in college because it was offered at college and I could get college credits for taking dance classes as electives and doing the thing that I loved and earning college credit for it. So I thought that was cool. I stayed with it. But I excelled in academics. So dance was really, like I said, I was a hobbyist, and it was never going to be a professional career for me.
Right, right. But it was still obviously a labor of love in another way that, again, you connected to the music. Your body was essentially like kind of the instrument.
Yes, absolutely. That's definitely true.
So tell me a little bit about the college experience. What did you go to college for? What was that decision process like, et cetera?
Well, originally I was going to get an accounting degree because I enjoyed numbers and I was good with numbers. But this was in the very early days of information technology. And in fact, when I went to college in the early 80s, there was the term information technology hadn't even been invented yet. Back then they called it EDP, electronic data processing. So I got actually a management degree with a focus on information systems because the business degree in information systems didn't even exist yet. So, and when I was at college, you know, we were programming on, this was the last days of punch cards. I'm really, really am dating myself. And so we would program on punch cards and put the cards in the card reader and run our programs that way. And then we actually got dumb terminals, which were the precursors to like PCs, to where we could just, you know, type on a keyboard and see our program on the screen and run it that way. And so I got the programming bug. I went to college for accounting, but got sort of much more interested in the programming side of things and the, you know, the step-by-step logic of writing a program and then, you know, having it executed and getting this result that I programmed. And that was I excelled at that too. And I enjoyed the challenge of it.
And I assume there weren't very many women.
There were actually, I remember college friends of mine, there were a few of us. But yeah, we were a minority for sure.
So what was the future plan at that point? Were you thinking like, I'm going to go work for one of the, I'm thinking like maybe IBM or one of the big?
I did actually interview with IBM and they did not hire me. I was very disappointed, but I was, you know, I had aspirations to, at that point in time, coming out of college to ascend the corporate ladder and be making strategic business decisions for some big corporation somewhere. That was my career path as I had envisioned it. And partially because of my upbringing and, you know, having this sort of social conditioning that this was the path. You went to college and you got a good job and you worked your way up the ladder and that was success. And that's what life was about. So when I graduated from college, I ended up going to work for a major retailer here in Atlanta. They had their regional office here. And I was working, actually, I was working as an auditor of the IT department. I wasn't even actually doing actual IT work. I was auditing the projects and various other programs of the IT department. And so this was like, let me paint the picture for you, sort of mid-80s, and this was before laptops were even, these were very early days of laptops. Businesses did not have laptops. We did not even have voicemail. This was before voicemail. This was before email. So this is an office environment where everybody wore suits. And so I wore suits and pantyhose and heels. There was no casual Friday. There was no working remotely on your laptop from anywhere. That did not exist. So it was a very traditional office environment, and I was in it for the first couple of months here, this having achieved what I thought was my goal and my dream. And, you know, after a few months, I thought, you know, people do this 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week for 50 weeks out of the year for 40 years. And it just, I was horrified, and it was just seemed like such a soulless kind of life for me, and I was not really enjoying it. I enjoyed my work, but I didn't enjoy that. Just the whole corporate structure felt very, very unnatural. And, you know, getting up to, you know, waking up to an alarm every day and having to go to an office and working for somebody else. So it became very clear to me that I was doomed for this life of misery, or so I thought at the time. And so my escape was music. I was living in Atlanta. I started to go out and hear bands and get into the live music scene here, go to club shows. And that was, you know, I worked my drudgery job during the week. And then on the weekends, I escaped into live music and how, you know, and the uplifting. And that was uplifting for me because that's what live music does. It really uplifts you and it takes you to a different place and it's transcendent and you get to escape.
What was the music scene like in Georgia at that time?
Well, there in Athens, which was a little bit outside of Atlanta, you had bands like the B-52s and REM. You know, those were when they were starting to hit. And there was a really strong local music scene sort of in the rock genre, bands like Driving and Crying. And this was the early days of Colonel Bruce Hampton and the Aquarium Rescue Unit. And they went on to be very groundbreaking in the jam band scene. There was a band called Follow For Now, and they were Atlanta's black rock band, and they had the distinction of being one of like the third black rock band that was signed to a major label along with Fishbone and 24/7 Spies. This was before the rap scene in Atlanta was happening. I mean, now Atlanta is a rap and hip hop mecca, but this was before those days. A band called the Georgia Satellites, they were sort of a one-hit wonder band, and they were happening at that time. So,
and did you just come across them as you were going out to the clubs, or were you sort of an avid specific follower of certain bands, or how did you kind of discover all this?
Well, I actually had a coworker who sort of introduced me to the live music scene in Atlanta. And from there, I just would just check the local, the weekly Creative Loafing was our weekly arts and entertainment paper. And I would just check the listings because this is before the internet where you could just look up and see who was playing everywhere online. But, you know, they had the printed listings of who was playing where. And I would check the listings and see who I wanted to empathy. I also had a very good friend of mine whose fiance was a musician, and so he was out gigging every weekend regionally. So she was my music buddy, and so she and I would be going out and seeing whoever it was that was hot that weekend, you know?
That's really fun. And I just had, like, when you were talking about it, I was thinking about, I mean, I grew up East Coast in the 80s, but I have a very, like, visceral memory of hearing B-52s. My stage name is El Ariel. My real name is Claire. So when they came out with Planet Claire, I was like, oh, you know, like, it was amazing. And it was just such a crazy, yeah, unique, original sound. And then REM, of course, I think, like, just kind of blew the doors off and their style of music. And, you know, we're sort of pioneers. So, I mean, you're in a real hotbed activity and various music genres taking off and new sounds coming out. So I just think that's so cool that you were kind of just out there, you know, when you could, nights and weekends, just, like, fully immersing yourself in it. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah. And that's really my musical horizons, you know, got really expanded just by exploring the local scene, and also by bands like Colonel Bruce Hampton and the Aquarium Rescue Unit. I actually became my friends. We started hanging out, and they were into jazz and bluegrass and blues and everything, you know, all musical genres. And so just by my association with them and just by hanging out with them, not even during show, not only with the music that they played, which spanned just about every genre, but just hanging out with them and listening to what they were listening to, I started to get my horizons expanded to things like, you know, music that I hadn't paid attention to before, specifically like jazz, and, you know, dipping my feet back in bluegrass from my childhood days.
I love that. So where did all this take you? Like, what was the next steps after this?
So I mentioned that I had gone to work for this major retailer. And from there, I ended up working for a software house also in Atlanta that had clients. They had clients internationally. And so jumping forward to the early 90s, I got a work assignment that took me to Switzerland. And I was in Switzerland for about a year and a half. And I was thrilled compared to Atlanta and the artists that I had the opportunity to see in Atlanta, to be in Switzerland and to be in Europe and to have access to their music scene was like musical heaven. I could see jazz artists and blues artists, American jazz and blues artists in Europe that I couldn't see in Atlanta, because Europe, the music scene there, they're great appreciators of music and culture, more so than, you know, the scene in Atlanta back in the day. And so I could travel very short distances and see all these amazing artists. Plus, I could see artists from Africa and artists from South America that would come and tour regularly in Europe that I'd never have the opportunity to see in Atlanta. So again, you know, to talk about being able to escape the drudgery of my corporate gig, my musical world horizons were opened up even more just by being in Switzerland. I remember before going there, just looking at the map and seeing where I was in Fribourg, Switzerland, and realizing that I would be about a 30-minute drive away from Montreux, Switzerland, which Montreux is the home of the Montreux Jazz Festival, which started back in the late 60s. I mean, it's a coming up on 50 years that this festival has been happening, and just being thrilled that I would be able to attend the Montreux Jazz Festival, you know, having heard about it and its legendary status.
That's so cool. And so, I mean, I love the fact too that here you are in a foreign country and, you know, working at a company, and yet you certainly didn't sound sort of intimidated or like, oh, I should just lay low and like do my job. It was like, no, I'm going to go out and really experience this and experience their music scene. And I love that. I mean, that to me shows that you really did have a true passion no matter where you were.
Oh, yeah. I took full advantage of the opportunities to see everything that Switzerland and the rest of Europe had to offer, really. I traveled to France and London and Germany and just for concerts. I thought I was kind of, I remember going to a travel agent because the Europeans, I mean, when they go on vacation, they go for 3 weeks and they're gone. And I remember going to a travel agent because this is, again, before you could book your own travel online, going to a travel agent and just wanting to go fly to London for a weekend because, you know, a friend of mine was playing a concert there. And they just looked at me like I was crazy. Like, why did I only want to go for 3 days? And I was like, I'm sorry you don't get it, but can you just please book the ticket?
Right,
I'm going.
Totally. I love it. So take us to the next chapter. So you're doing IT, you're working in foreign lands, and then what happened?
Going to shows and going to music festivals. Well, what happened was about a year after I had been working in Switzerland, I was at this beautiful little 2-day music festival in Lausanne, Switzerland, called La Dolce Vita Festival. And I met a guy there and we got to talking, and he was mentioned that he was on, you know, the staff of the Montreux Jazz Festival. And I just said, very offhand, I said, oh, I would be interested in working the festival. And he said, oh, I can arrange that. And this was in like the March of 1993, I think. And that's for that summer festival. And he did. So here I am in 1993 working the Montreux Jazz Festival and just being thrilled that, and this was my first professional gig, although it was a volunteer position. And as you may or may not know, every music festival, no music festival can function without its volunteer staff.
Good point.
And Montreux Jazz Festival is no exception to that. And so they have a staff of volunteers that do things like, I worked in the main auditorium and I did ushering and stage security. And I was fine with that because my payment was that I got to see all the shows for free. And Montreux was a 16-day festival. So just 16 nights of all of the top artists in every genre, really, with a very, very high production value. The production value of Montreux is kind of legendary. So I was getting to see all these great artists, basically from essentially a front row vantage point, and getting to experience just the quality presentation that Montreux brought every year. And so I was just thrilled to have the opportunity to do that. So every year after that, I just kept coming back, because once I got on their list, you know, the next year I got the application and I completed it, and I just went back every summer. And that's what I did on my summer vacation. I went to Montreux, Switzerland, and I worked at the Montreux Jazz Festival.
Wow.
So in 1994, by the time the next year came around, I was back home in Atlanta, but, you know, and I was working my day job still, but I just took those 3 weeks every summer and went back and worked the festival. And in the meantime, I had gotten to know some of the people on the permanent staff. There was only about 9 people who were actually on full-time permanent staff of the Montreux Jazz Festival. But following year, they had the Montreux venue was this, the Congress Center, and there were a couple of main stages where they had ticketed concerts, and they had decided to build out the basement. The basement was huge. You could drive trucks in there and park trucks in there. They built out a part of the basement and turned it into a club that they called Montreux Jazz Cafe. And they had, it was free entry, and they had a program of up-and-coming artists, and they also had DJs, and then they would have the jam sessions, the late-night jam sessions, there where the main stage artists would come down and play jam sessions. And so they needed somebody to do artist hospitality for that stage. And so they asked me if I would do it. And I said, sure. So from that point on, I had a paid position with Montreux Jazz Festival. And I did that for 5 years, providing artists hospitality for their jazz cafe stage. And that was a lot of fun. Yeah. We had a lounge that we had set up, and everybody came through there, staff and musicians. And it was basically, I was hosting a party every night for great artists.
That's so great. I love it. And so this was just in the summer, right? It was just confined to the
festival.
Yes, it's
in July.
Got it.
Always, yes,
okay.
Yes.
So you still had the day job, and you were basically working during your vacation?
Yes, I still had the day job that I had transitioned into a contracting. Mm-hmm. So I was able to work a little more independently and set my own schedule. And then by that time, technology had advanced to where I could work at home. So that really created a lot of flexibility for me. So, you know, this whole time, I really had not ever, I'd never really thought that I could do something full-time in music, that I could work full-time in music and work full-time, you know, in this arena that I really loved. I was just, it was still sort of my escape, even though it became, my escape became, you know, this 3-week working stint in the summer in Montreux, which was huge. And, but I was still, I was like, I've got to do something to get out of this corporate grind. I've got to do something. And so I went to massage school. Thinking that I would ease my way out of information technology and then and build this massage practice. And that was what I had as my next career direction. And what I remembered is I really enjoyed massage school. I enjoyed everything I learned in massage school. But when I got out of massage school, what I realized is that I did not want to have a career as a full-time massage therapist either. But this was right when Y2K was approaching. So that was also the wrong time to get out of information technology, because there was a tremendous amount of work to make systems Y2K compliant. And so I realized that it was smarter for me to stay in IT doing this contract work until Y2K came and went. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was that I realized that the key for me for getting out of the corporate world was to become debt free and have very low overhead. And so I was able to do that. I took my IT consulting money. I had bought a house. I paid off my mortgage. I had no debt. I had very low overhead. And so I set a goal to quit my job when Y2K hit, or quit IT, and I did it. I got my house paid off in 1999, and then the year 2000, I quit full-time IT work so that I could focus on developing my music career somewhat. So the year 2000 was, I had sort of like finally gotten out from underneath this yoke of the day job. And it was kind of a pivotal year for me. And I did a lot of traveling. One of the things that I did was I went to Mali in February of that year. Mali is a country in West Africa that has a huge, strong musical culture. And over the course of my musical exploration, I'd found myself really delving into the music of West Africa, Malian music, all of that. The rhythms really appealed to me, the drums, the percussion. Like I said, I was a drum and bass girl. So the rhythms of the West African music really spoke to me and really hit me viscerally. And this trip to Mali was it was organized by Afropop Worldwide. They're a nonprofit organization that promotes African music, the music of Africa and African diaspora in North America. They have a radio program and a podcast now. And so it was just a group of people who were really into Malian music and West African music. And so we were immersed in the musical culture of Mali every day. We traveled with Malian musicians, and just, it was really a magical trip. And one of the musicians that was traveling with us was the bass player for Ali Farka Touré. Ali Farka Touré is probably one of the best known musicians from Mali. He's an international touring artist, and I learned from his bass player that they were going to be touring in the U.S. later that year, and that was going to be Ali Farka Touré's last tour ever, because he was retiring to go back to his community and farm and grow food for his community. And so when I got back to Atlanta, I had the tour itinerary, and Atlanta was not one of the cities where they were going to be playing. So I approached these couple promoters in the city and tried to get them interested, and they weren't really interested. And I was just like, this has to be done. You know, this just has to be done. And I thought, you know, I've been working Montreux Jazz Festival for, you know, 6 or 7 years at that time. I know enough about how to put on a show. I can do this. I can be the promoter. Show. And so I floated the idea to a few friends and a few people in my circle, and everybody was like, yeah, I'll help you. And so that was my one and only foray into being a concert promoter. And it was terrifying. I remember calling up the booking agent on the phone and not knowing really what to say, and hearing the fee and jaw dropping open, but just, I was like, I was driven. And you know, booking the venue and coming up with promotional strategy, because that was like pre-Facebook. There was, you know, internet advertising really wasn't a thing. It was print media, radio, posters and flyers and email. That's how you got the word out about a show. I had, like I said, I was actually working on an IT project at that time, and I took that money and I funded this concert. It was never about me trying to do this as a money-making venture. It was a labor of love to bring this fantastic artist to Atlanta so that Atlanta would have a chance to appreciate him live on his last ever tour. And I pulled it off with my army of volunteers. It was like, it was kind of like, hey gang, let's put on a show. And we did it, and it was successful. And I remember, I'll never forget getting the email from the venue owner, who was also, he actually was a promoter. He was one of the promoters that I approached about doing the show. And he was like, nah. And I ended up booking his venue to do the show, and then got an email from him the next day saying, the staff here is totally blown away by the number of people you got to come out for the show.
Oh, that's fantastic.
In their history of presenting African artists, they had never gotten a good turnout. So it was a success. The show was amazing. I was floating on a cloud. It was a great experience for the audience. It was a great experience for the band. And so the thing that I learned about that, though, was that I did not want to be a concert promoter. I was very clear about that. But that really got me thinking, well, you know, maybe I can do something in the realm of live music. I just have to figure out what it is. And so from that point, I went back and worked at Montreux Jazz Festival again that summer. And actually, the concert was in August. And then when I got back, I had learned from the guys at Afropop about this world music conference that happened every year in Europe. It's called WOMEC. And everybody in North America that's involved with presenting artists, world music artists, really, for lack of a better term. Everyone who's involved in presenting world music artists in North America, it's a kind of a small, tight-knit group of presenters and booking agents and people involved with PR and visas and all of that. And all of those people go to WOMEX. Sean Barlow from Apropop said, you know, if you want to get connected in with these folks, then you need to come to WOMEX. And so I did. It was in Berlin that year. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to jump back to the concert. I presented Ollie Farquhar-Touré in concert in Atlanta. Ollie Farquhar-Touré's tour manager was a woman named Deborah Cohen. And Deborah became a mentor to me. And she really was an inspiration to me as far as my touring career and getting on the road. She was amazing. She spoke six languages fluently and another six languages a little bit. And she toured with all of the big names in world music. She was their tour manager, toured internationally with all of them. And she had a resume like she, for example, she had started MTV Brazil way back when MTV was starting to propagate around the world. So she had very, very heavy credentials. And the first tour manager that I'm meeting is this really amazing woman. To have, you know, Deborah Cohen as a role model and my first real pivotal person in my touring career and became a mentor to me and really inspired me and encouraged me, you know, to go down this path of getting into live music business and touring specifically.
That's so great. Can you tell us, so I want to hear that about your career in that. So can you tell us about your touring experience? Like, was it in the States? Was it overseas? Was it all of the above?
When I went to the WOMEX conference in October, I met a booking agent there who is based in Seattle. Her name is Allison Lurkey, and she had a boutique. She was a one-person operation with the boutique roster of world music artists and some jazz artists. And she was looking to maybe expand and add a booking agent. And so that was my first step, was to become her East Coast, her booking agent based on the East Coast with her being in Seattle. And what I discovered pretty much immediately was the booking part of touring didn't interest me either. What interested me was the logistics part of it, the putting together the tours and figuring out the travel and getting it all booked and gathering all the details into a tour book, making the tour actually happen at the nuts and bolts level. So instead of becoming a booking agent for her, I ended up doing her production work and her logistic work for her artists who were coming over and touring in the U.S. and Canada. And she was the one, it was then in 2002, after I'd done production for several of her artists in 2001. In 2002, she was bringing over Degary, who is a guitarist from Madagascar, who was an amazing world-class guitarist, and he didn't speak any English. And from all the years that I'd spent, from the time that I'd spent in Switzerland, I'd picked up enough French to passable French to be able to communicate with French-speaking artists enough to, you know, go on tour with them and handle all of their needs. And since Degary didn't speak any English but did speak French, she hired me to do Degary's tour here in the U.S. So that was my first tour. And this was, I remember just feeling totally going by the seat of my pants and really like figuring it out as I went. And there were some fortuitous things that happened. Like, you know, I think our first gig was in Chicago. So we all flew into Chicago. I met him at the airport, and there happened to be a couple of guys there who had been Peace Corps volunteers in Madagascar, and they knew he was coming to play. And so they were at the airport. They spoke Malagasy, which is the language of Madagascar. So they kind of came along with us those first couple of days and were able to really help with the communication, because here I am, first time tour manager, trying to figure out what I'm doing as a tour manager and working with an artist that I'd met for the very first time and trying to do all this in French. And it was like, if I'd known what I was getting myself into, I might have thought twice about it, but it all worked out and it was a lovely tour. And that was, my passion was really stoked at that point.
That's so great. And so did you just continue with this tour company and just keep working, or what happened?
So after I did my first tour with Degary in 2002, I realized that touring is where I fit in this business, because it combines my love of music and travel, and it utilizes my organizational and logistic skills to be able to serve artists, to do what they do, and to bring their artistry to audiences. And so I knew that this was the path that I wanted to go down. And at the time, though, I had my foot in the IT world. I was doing the IT contract work. That was my bread and butter. That was paying my bills. And I was making my foray into tour management. And so it was a solid, like, 12 years that I was operating still in both of those worlds. And growing the touring side happened pretty slowly, because my decision to get in that business didn't mean that those opportunities just started flowing my way and flooding my inbox. That's not how it works. It takes time to...
That's a really good point, and I'm so glad you shared that, because I think a lot of people have this idea of instant gratification. And I think sometimes even things like the internet and social media perpetuate that to make it seem like everybody can be an overnight success, and so can you. So I think it's really important to share that, making the decision is just the first step, and then you have to actually like do the...
You have to slog it out.
You have to slog it out. So tell us about that.
The slog it out part for me comes a little bit later in the game. I was sort of floating along, like I said, doing the IT contract work and doing a little bit of tour work here and there, and just really trying to build my network. That's the work that's required to work in the touring business. It's because, again, it's all about who you know and who knows you. So building your professional network is just as important as work in your gigs. There came a point in time where I was found myself in a situation where I needed steady income again. And the freelance life, that's one of the biggest, hardest things to manage in the freelance life, is just the having income sporadically. So I ended up taking a full-time job again in IT, where I had a commute. I was working in a cubicle. And, you know, it was a means to an end, but it was really a point where I had to make a decision about what am I really going to do with my life from that point on. But this job basically dropped in my lap. It had a fat salary. It was more money than I made in any job prior. And at that point in time, I decided that I could leverage that in order to lay a financial foundation for myself to really get out. And it took me a few years to do that. So, I was in a situation when I was being in that job and having that kind of lifestyle again, the 9-to-5 lifestyle, being a single person with no kids and no debt. I had no excuses to not do what I wanted to do with my life. And I just had to decide to not let fear hold me back from doing what I love, working with artists and doing those things with which bring me joy. So at that point in time, I created an exit strategy. I had to do things like, my car was almost 20 years old. I needed to buy a car that was going to take me 20 years into the future and be reliable when I didn't have money, steady money. And I loaded up my 401k and my retirement accounts. I just maxed those out as much as I could and put aside a financial cushion. And then I took the plunge and I quit my job in December of 2011 and did not look back. And that's when I went full time into the slog of finding gigs and getting gigs. And at the beginning, I took any gig that came my way just to have that experience to build my resume. Because at that point, I did two tours, actually only two tours in the 5 years that I was in my day job. And I had a few tours under my belt already from prior. So I needed to build my resume. I took any gig that came my way and I got lucky. Fortunate circumstances, networking, all those things together, my luck and my hard work. I got three really good solid tours in my first year. And then I went from there. Well, the second year wasn't not so strong. And I actually ended up driving for one of the rideshare services for just a few months in the off season, just to cover the bills. I was willing to do that. And then it just kept building from there, though. You know, I built my network. People started, they knew who I was. I was building my reputation. And so I started seeing a return from that.
That's phenomenal. I love that. And I think too, you know, you were saying like I was only able to do a couple tours when I was working my day job. I mean, no wonder.
Right.
It's like you're required to be in an office for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. How the hell would you pot? Like, I think it's amazing that you actually were able to even do two tours, you know?
Well, this was a situation again, you know, when I had my first professional gig at Montreux Jazz Festival, that's what I did on my summer vacation. And one of those tours that I did during my job, that's I took my vacation time and it was a 2.5 week tour. So, you know, I managed to work it out with my boss. And he was open to it. I was sort of an anomaly in the office in that I did have this side hustle going in the music business. And, you know, he thought it was interesting. And he also understood. I remember I was actually even able to say to him, and he got it. I said, I want to do work that's meaningful and fulfilling. And this is not it.
Good for you.
Yeah. So he knew and he worked with me because, you know, I was a valuable employee. I was doing good work for them. I was kicking ass for them, as a matter of fact. So he knew that if he wanted to keep me on, that it was in his best interest and in the company's best interest to let me do this, go do my tour and then come back and hit the ground running again.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that tour was, and that was a tour where it was like, I was not going to pass up that opportunity because it was with Bela Fleck, who is a multi-Grammy winning banjo. He's taken banjo places where it never should go, as he says, even himself.
Yeah.
And it was a tour he did a collaboration with African artists and recorded it and put it out. And then now he was doing this tour where the show was him presenting these a few different African artists that he'd recorded with and then him playing with them. And that was, I was assistant tour manager on that tour with that major artist. And I was not going to pass up that opportunity. I would have quit my job had I not been allowed to take the vacation to do it.
That's great.
That was how important it was.
Do you want to talk about now what you're doing, like where you've ended up?
Yes. I'm in this sort of interesting little niche where most of the artists that I work with are from outside the U.S. I've always had a fascination with basically people who are not like me and cultures that are different from mine. And I've always wanted to explore and get to know those cultures. And I've been able to do that in my touring career, working with artists from all over Africa and Asia and a few European artists and one South American artist. And that's what I love. And I've been with my tours, like with Daguerre, the first artist I ever toured with. I did several tours with him. I do a lot of tours with artists. It's their first time touring in the U.S. and Canada, touring in North America. And oftentimes, which is for me a measure of my success, is that when they come back next year, that they want me to do their tour again. A lot of times, artists from outside the U.S., they tour once a year. And so if they come back and they want me to do the tour again, then I know I've done a good job for them. So I have several artists where I've done multiple tours. And then I got involved with a program of the U.S. State Department that is a cultural exchange program.
Oh, wow.
It's called Center Stage. And they have, the program is to bring artists from countries that are selected by the State Department, organize tours for those artists, and they come and tour and they perform and they do community activities. And the point of the program is for cultural engagement. So I've been involved with that program since its first touring cycle in 2012. And so I get to have a real mix of art since the State Department chooses the countries. I've been able to have this cultural engagement with all kinds of artists from cultures that I would otherwise never be exposed to. So I really love that.
It sounds phenomenal. So I have a final question for you. What do you think it is about you that made you keep going? Like, why didn't you give up? Why did you keep going? And were you so determined to really have this music career?
Well, I'll go back to what I said before, looking at myself and my life as a single person with no kids and no debt, and being able to create a financial foundation so that I could do what I love, because life is not about money and things. For me, life is about experiences. And being such a music lover and music fanatic, while not being a musician or having that artistic talent at all, music always fed me. And to be able to make that a career, to where I was being fed even more, and at the same time being able to make a contribution to that, to where audiences can be fed. I mean, the magic that happens between artists and audiences when everybody's really on, it kind of takes on a life of its own and everybody is uplifted. And to be able to do that on a day-to-day basis. Just the example really that comes to mind, a very strong example to me that comes to mind, is this band Mukumba from Zimbabwe. I did their first tour in North America. It was 44 days. We spent 3 weeks on the Canadian festival circuit. And so people were just seeing them for the very first time. And their show is amazing. And it moves people in ways that not all artists do. I mean, I've seen grown men cry at their shows, at some of the things that they do, and just people dancing, and just the energy is amazing. And to see that, you know, by the end of the third week, when we got to Vancouver Music Festival, it's like their reputation had preceded them. People already sort of knew who they were. The buzz was amazing. And so to see them bring their artistry and the effect that it had on audiences, and the fact that I get to see every single show. I'm getting that dose for, you know, this whole 44-day tour, and it's, you know, moving me as on day 44 as much as it did on day one. You know, that's my reward. That is part of my payment and my compensation, is to get that soul fulfilling. This is, you know, it's work that's meaningful and fulfilling, and this is what I want to do.
That's so fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I think you just have such an incredible and inspiring story, and I'm so grateful that you were able to take the time and to share it with us. So thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
My special thanks to Teresa. What a phenomenal, incredible story, and just so important to just not give up no matter what. Just don't give up, you know. Keep up that grit, that determination. Follow that love of music, follow your dreams, follow your passion. Like Teresa, just so grateful that she could take the time to share her story with us. I think the best way to reach Teresa is on LinkedIn. It's Teague is her last name, Teague. So just look up Teresa Teague on LinkedIn. Okay, my loves, thus ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? We are at musicjobspodcast.com, on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. I am your hostess with mostest, L. Ariel. That's L. Ariel. You can find me, my website is lariel music.com. That's lariel music.com, or social media at lariel music. I've released a music video with my cover song of The Goddess Sade's Cherish the Day. If you want to check that out, it's on my YouTube channel. Just look for L. Ariel. Okay, babies, that's all I got. So take good care. And remember, we're going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.